Hello, this is David Cross of Bowtie Tours, and today we are chasing American history. Today we are doing our third segment on the United States Constitution. We're going to be continuing our discussion of Benjamin Franklin. Then we're going to move on and talk a little bit about Thomas Jefferson next week. And after that, we're going to go on to another subject for a little while, which I'll tell you at a later date, I suppose. Now, before we get started, I want to talk to you about the Great Courses series. This is a series that includes the greatest professors throughout the country on all different types of subjects. I see today that they have three new releases they're offering. One is called Law School for Everyone. I would avoid that one. The other one is called Understanding Imperial China. Sounds good. And the other is The Psychology of Performance. Whatever your interest is, there are experts who discuss your subject in interesting and informative ways. I've listened to several lectures about Beethoven and classical music and Mozart, and I'm not a real classical music expert by any degree. You know, these people, sometimes you listen to something that you know a great deal about, but sometimes you want to hear something that you know absolutely nothing about. And they have the best teachers. They have people who are able to talk really to both of those sets of people at the same time. So I could not feel more strongly than I do that if you go out and get some of these courses, that you are going to be delighted. And I believe they have a guarantee. You can return the course if you get it, and it isn't what you were looking for. But as I say, I've taken many of these courses. They come directly to my phone. They have the books and the notes on there, so I can look at the notes either on my iPad or my phone. I can listen to them while I'm driving. These are wonderful courses. Now, we're going to get started today talking about, as I said, the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin. But before we do that, I'm going to respond to an email I received from a listener. This is a lady who doesn't want me to use her name. And that's cool, because that's how we all got started, you know. Nobody used their names back in the day, you know. The Federalist Papers were not written by James Madison or Alexander Hamilton or John Jay. That was Publius, and you had Cato, and you had Caesar. You had all these different pseudonyms because, well, for one reason, you didn't want to get tarred and feathered. I was just reading a book by Pauline Mayer today before I came in here, and she was talking about the fact that there were people specifically threatening at the time of the ratification process that anybody who writes anything against the Constitution should be tarred and feathered. So things haven't changed so much. You know, we have a situation where we have the whole country going nuts over whether you can take a knee or not before a football game, over the meaning and value of statues. And again, it seems like a lot of people don't want anybody disagreeing with them. Let's put it that way. And anyway, this is a lady who is a public school teacher, so that's why she doesn't want little bureaucratic ears listening to what she had to say. But this is what she wrote. She writes, "Sir, I enjoyed the podcast, The Constitution Part 1, specifically the portion from approximately 14 to 18 minutes in which you discuss the woeful state of the teaching of U.S. history." I don't remember exactly what I said. "I have to mention," she goes on, "I have to mention two other harmful factors. Firstly, the so-called No Child Left Behind years, 2002 to 2015, in which the demonstrable harm of it ain't tested, it ain't taught eviscerated U.S. history in our public schools. Secondly, the dominant school of hard left history education in our universities compounded the problem by turning out a generation of half-informed history teachers trained in an extremely critical postmodernist progressive educators who, like lambs to the slaughter, were too scared or too stupid to determine how to teach inclusive and engaging version of history. I should note that on numerous occasions I had to justify my pedagogical and scholarly justification for when my lessons were something other than the banal, vanilla, inoffensive tripe handed to me. Whoa! So, let me say this. When I talk about this subject, I don't talk about it from the inside. I don't really know what it's like on the inside of the schools. I've been involved in two ways. I've been involved as a parent, and I'm involved as a person who gives tours and listening to the level of background and education the people who are on my tours have. I will say that if there are people out there listening right now, people who are teachers, you have my respect and you have my thanks. It kind of sounds like I'm running for office, but I have more respect for you than I ever have before in my life. I do like to feel that in a way I teach when I give lectures, when I give my tours, but frankly what I do is so easy compared to the idea of coming into a middle school and facing 30 students, some of which may look very blasé, some of which don't want to be here. Well, let's face it, most of which don't want to be there. You know, what I do is easy. These are people who have paid to hear me talk. That always helps. People don't seem to understand. When people pay for your service, they want to like you. Because by liking you, they're validating their own decision to pay you. You know, I used to tell lawyers this all the time. They wanna like you. Especially when you're in private, they've handed out the money, they've paid for you. Well, they want to feel like they got the best lawyer. They want to be able to brag. So you're halfway there. It's like a comedy club. They want to laugh. They're halfway there. They're drinking. They're ready. Doesn't make it any less hard, I suppose, if you're out there on the stage. But these are things you should be cognizant of. When you're a teacher in a school, I think sometimes you must feel like you're in enemy territory. And you have to deal with the parents. You have to deal with the bureaucrats in your school. And you have to deal with the world as it is right now. I mean, we don't care about American history. We don't. Let's face it, we've said it every way we can. We don't test it. Only people who have to take a test on American history are people coming into the country, immigrants, which is why sometimes they're the best educated people I give tours to. Nobody else needs to. Now, I'm not saying there aren't classes that they take, there aren't, but if it's a subject where they're not making it part of these standardized tests, they're telling the kids and they're telling the students this stuff doesn't really matter. And so we have debates. We have debates. Should Kaepernick be able to take a knee? Should he be able to stand? I don't care what your opinion is on that. I just care that it has some basis in fact, reason, historical relevance. What we are as a country, what we stand for. Now, you can be knowledgeable and come onto either one of those two positions, but you should be knowledgeable. We're trying to create citizens here. How can that not matter? How can that not matter in a democracy whether the people we create know anything about their history or they don't? You know, I don't know how many people out there have had the experience of falling in love. Probably many. When you fall in love with somebody, and you think this person is the one, or maybe the one of the first things you do is tell that person your history. And one of the first things you do is listen to that person tell you their history. That's because we don't know each other, really, until we know that. Now, if you fall in love with somebody who's, say, they're scared of fire. Why are you scared of fire? Well, I had an experience as a child. And my aunt was horribly scarred. You know, you hear that story, and now you know that person a little better. Well, if we don't know our own story, what are we? If we don't know about the writs of assistance that I know all my listeners know about because we discussed it in the first episode of the Constitution, and for those of you who haven't heard that, turn me off right now and go back to episode one and hear about James Otis and the writs of assistance. But if we don't know about that, Maybe we say, like a lot of imbeciles in the Congress and the Senate, oh, this is reasonable to get lists from the White House and just follow them slavishly. Why not? There's no root. Is there anything wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with that. Of course you don't, because you're not educated. You don't know your history. And I'm speaking right now to people in the Congress, people in the Senate. We're in a crisis, folks. And everybody should be teaching their kids history, not one political side of things, not just conservatives, not just liberals, everybody. This is our country, all of us. And if we don't understand these things, if we don't understand our Constitution, we don't understand the Declaration of Independence, and we don't know who we are. And that's a pretty scary thing. I always tell people, you know, I take people on trips that we've spoken about in the past, and we discuss George Washington or we discuss Thomas Jefferson. I don't care if you like these people or not. Honest to God, I don't, because you have every right to say, listen, this guy held slaves. That's the line for me. You go beyond that line, you're a slaveholder. You're no good in my book. You have every right to make that. It's perfectly reasonable. Not a lot of us say, well, this guy was a Nazi, but I'm okay with him. So I don't care if you like him or not, but you should know about them. If for no other reason than the rights we have right now were assured and granted and fought for by these people, whether they knew it or not. And to understand those rights, we need to understand what they were thinking. Not be bound by them necessarily. You know, there's no reason in the world to be arguing about gun ownership through the eyes of people who have never heard of semi-automatic guns and didn't live in the world as we live in it. Again, I don't care which side you come out on, but we have to understand not only the things that are the same from the past and now, but the things that are different, and the fact that they created a constitution that can be amended. They didn't want to put people into a straitjacket. But there's a great statue of Benjamin Franklin. We're talking about Benjamin Franklin today. Maybe I'll try to get a picture of this. I'm having some technological problems, but I'm going to try to get a picture of this statue for the front of this podcast. And the statue of Benjamin Franklin shows him, he's all wrapped up in a Roman toga, and he's surrounded by books, and he's holding a scepter, and he's holding it upside down. So what does that tell us? Well, Roman toga, we're a democracy. People make the decisions in this country. But see, that goes hand in hand with the books. People need to know what they're voting about. People need to know what they're talking about. That's important. That's a duty. To have some basis of knowledge. Don't become somebody parroting some talking head you heard. Don't do that. Now, we all have limited time. There's only so much we can all figure out. I always tell my son, you know, in a lot of ways, being young is the best time in the world, but it's also the worst, because you're always tested on things you don't care about and you don't know about and you're not good at. And adults don't have to do that. You know, if you get good at one thing, like people tell me how smart I am, boy, am I an idiot about most things. They think I'm smart because I know about James Otis. So that's the cool thing about being an adult. I might not be able to pick out the right change to hand you, but I know about James Otis, and that works. But anyway, so I don't expect that everyone's going to become knowledgeable about everything. But you have to be knowledgeable about some things, and you have to be knowledgeable about the important things. I love that David Halberstam book, The Best and the Brightest. I had the incredible good fortune to be able to meet David Halberstam and interview him, and boy, was he a fantastic, fascinating person. One of my, I guess, two favorite writers who write historical kind of works. I love Halberstam. I love Robert Caro. And I got to interview both of them. And Robert Caro told me that before Halberstam's death, the two of them had a discussion. And Halberstam told Caro, he said, you know, we're the last two. And what he meant is, We don't live in a culture where anyone's going to pay people to take 10 years to write a history book anymore. These were the last two that are going to get away with it. And of course, we've lost David Halberstam in a car accident, which is a just tragedy, not only for him and his family, but for all of us. His final book was about the Korean War. It was a wonderful book. And what I love about Halberstam is he writes about everything. You know, he'll write an incredible book like his final one, big, heavy, historical book. But he'll also write books about the 47 Yankees. You know, whatever he writes about, it's worth reading. And if you haven't read The Best and the Brightest, you should do that. So anyway, so I'll call her Publius. I thank Publius for writing that in. You know a lot more about what's going on than I do. I see the result, and I have some guesswork as to what's going on, but I've said it before, I'll say it again. We are in a crisis in terms of the historical self-knowledge of this country. You know, Williamsburg, Virginia right now is losing, during the summer, $150,000 a day. And that's because, for a variety of reasons, again, I'm guessing, what do I know? But I'm guessing it's because families aren't taking their children on historically based vacations. You know, kids now, when I was a kid, I went to Knoxville. All my son's friends, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to Bermuda. Where are you going? Oh, I'm going to Hawaii. Where are you going? Oh, Paris. If you're out there and you're complaining about this, let me tell you something. Don't assume the schools are going to teach your kid about American history. So if that's important to you, you need to do it. I'm going to take my family out on a Gettysburg trip in a few weeks, so I'm boning up on that because we have a Gettysburg tour. I do it along with our highly respected military expert, Wilson Dorwood, but I'm going to take my family and try to muddle through on my own with Gettysburg and see how that goes. But you know, next summer, if you don't feel like your kids are learning history, take them to Boston. Walk them along the Freedom Trail. Come to Philadelphia. Contact us at Bowtie Tours. We'll give you a tour, the Philadelphia, the Independence Extraordinaire Tour. We'll take you inside where the Declaration of Independence was signed, show you where it was written, discuss the Constitution, take you out to Valley Forge, show you why that's an important place. Go to Gettysburg. You know, it doesn't even matter. Get your kids to start thinking about history. Do what you can do. You know what? It might not work. They might roll their eyes, they might not care, and they might never care. They also might roll their eyes and not care, but then years later, they're glad it happened. You know, you just kind of got to do things as parents. My dad, every year for New Year's, used to make us eat black-eyed peas and corn pone. My dad made the worst corn pone in the history of corn pone. And any dentist alive would tell you, you don't want to get near this corn pone because it was like a rock. I don't know what that man did, but he would make this rock corn pone and he would give you black-eyed peas. And oh, how I complained and I moaned and, you know, I couldn't stand it. I would eat one of these black-eyed peas and gag. Well, of course, now I make sure, I've always made sure my daughter had the black-eyed peas. Now my daughter's off. She's in Greece right now. I can't make her eat the black-eyed peas, but I can make my son eat the black-eyed peas. And neither one of them is any happier about it than I was. But you never know, because now I love black-eyed peas. I wish I could reproduce the rock corn pone. I don't even know how to do that. I eat grits. I love grits now. I couldn't stand it. It made me gag. So anyway, you know, don't let your kids decide what's good for them, all right? Because they don't know. They really don't. We've got things turned around thinking that they know what's best for them. They don't know a damn thing. They think they do, but they don't. So if you're concerned, you know, they're not going to start teaching the kids American history until about the seventh grade. So you need to jump on this thing earlier than that. If you got enough money to take them to Hamilton, heck, it's worth it. It's worth it. Get them excited in history. Let them know why it's important. Don't just ask for their opinions. Make them have a reason for their opinion. Why do you think that? Why do you think it's wrong for Kaepernick to take a knee? Why do you think it's right? What do you think about these statues? Should they be out there? Should these people be allowed to march through the town and scream racist Nazi comments to citizens? Should they be allowed to do that? Or should the government say, no, you can't say those things? Really? Why? Open a dialogue with your kids and let them know how interesting history can be. Because once you've opened that door for them, you've given them the greatest gift they can have. And take them to Williamsburg if you can. Poor place needs your help, all right? Okay, well, enough of that. Let's get on to the Constitution, Episode 4. Now, when we left off, we were talking about Benjamin Franklin, and I believe we were discussing his Join or Die political cartoon. It showed the Union cut up into pieces. It included the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and New England. It said join or die. Now, this was Benjamin Franklin being an early advocate of taking these colonies and placing them into one country. Now, it's been said that this was the very first political cartoon ever printed in America. Franklin discussed a plan of unification with several governors, but governors usually wanted to create a system in which the British would hold main control of making choices. Of course, the governors were chosen by the British. Franklin went on and said that the people of the colonies consider themselves as loyal and as firmly attached to the present constitution and reigning family as any subjects of the king's dominions. Now, I think I already mentioned to you the book about Benjamin Franklin called The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin by Gordon Wood. Gordon Wood, by the way, is putting out a brand new book about the relationship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. So that should be exciting. It's a story that's been told. It's been told many times. So I love it when very talented writers take on a story that you think you've heard enough and you think you've heard it from every angle, and then they find something new. So keep in touch. I'll let you know what I think of this book, whether it adds something new or whether it's the same old story. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it coming out. But so Franklin believes that the people of America want to be loyal subjects to England. But Franklin also believes that the people in America deserve the same rights as anybody in England. And under the British Constitution, you have the right to representation if you're going to be taxed. That's real basic. So Franklin understands that, sure, these people want to be part of the British Empire, but they want the same rights as anybody else in the British Empire. And they want representation. Now, when Governor Shirley of Massachusetts proposed that the colonies receive representation in Parliament, Franklin thought the idea was a good one as long as they had a reasonable number of representatives and that all the old acts of Parliament constraining the trade or cramping the manufactures of the colonies be at the same time repealed, and the British subjects on this side the water put in those respects on the same footing with those in Great Britain till the new Parliament. You see, Franklin is not Sam Adams. Sam Adams, truth be known, doesn't want to be part of the Parliament. He wants his own Parliament. He wants to be listening to the Massachusetts Congress. He wants the colonies to have their own people because he feels that there's a difference in the interests between the two parties. Franklin's not there yet. Franklin is much more moderate than Sam Adams. Franklin wants to bring the parties together to work together, but he wants the Americans to have the same rights as anybody else in the British Empire. So it's going to take a little while before Benjamin Franklin is going to become a revolutionary. He's a moderate for much of this time period, and so he's very distrusted by both sides, because the British think, well, he's always pushing these American points of view at us, and the Americans think, well, he's been in England so long, he's probably a British spy. Now, if England had listened to Benjamin Franklin and tried to do something like this, I don't know what would have happened. But Parliament's not about to agree to anything that gives the colonies that kind of power. And they probably would have voted down any suggestion of giving them even token representation. You know, when you study the American Revolution and you grow up, I was born in England, but I grew up in America, it's important to look at it and look at it with an unbiased eye. It's important not to be a homer, not to look at it in terms of everything England does is terrible and stupid and everything America does is right. Obviously, we want to analyze this on a higher level. But you can't help but notice that England makes mistake after mistake after mistake, and many of them just born out of arrogance. The idea that many in England, not all, but many in England think that the Americans are going to go along with a system where they don't have any kind of representation is absurd. It's not going to happen. Look at the world going around you. Look at the world. You know, I all last year, during the presidential election, I kept wondering how the Democrats thought that the most establishment candidate they had ever produced was going to win, when if you looked around the world, establishment candidates were going down everywhere. If you look around the world in the 1750s, 1760s, the Enlightenment is everywhere. People are demanding their rights. People are arguing what John Locke is arguing. You know, these are people from England, for the most part, talking about these things, saying all men are created equal, saying all people have a right to their own representation. These aren't foreign doctrines. These are coming out of England. So to think, well, we love John Locke, but we're just going to tell the colonies what to do, is at the very least not likely to succeed. Franklin can't understand why England seeks to treat the American citizens differently from those living in England. What imports it to the general state whether a merchant, a smith, or a hatter grow rich in old or new England? Now that's a question a lot of these founders are going to be asking. George Washington's going to be asking it. Why am I getting paid less than a British soldier of the same rank? What difference does it make that I was born here in America? Sam Adams is going to ask it. All of the revolutionaries are going to ask it. And when they never get a good answer, that's when we're going to have a revolution. Now, George Washington is going to have a defeat in 1754 after he goes out to kind of negotiate with the French. This is going to lead to what we in America call the French Indian War. Everybody else calls it the Seven Years' War. Now, because of the way events went, England's going to reform the army, and they're going to send out Major General Edward Braddock. And Braddock's going to meet with Benjamin Franklin. Braddock is very pleased when Franklin gives him a plan by which he can obtain horses and carriages. Braddock isn't really happy with the colonials. And George Washington, by the way, gets to be very jealous and unhappy. He's much more of a pro-Virginia person at this person. He has not yet reached that point where he's a nationalist, not anywhere near it. And so he's worried about trying to create a road that's going to be used for military purposes that'll go through Virginia, so it'll help the people who are part of a plan to purchase land that's out in the Pennsylvania area. He wants the road to be there, and he's very worried that Pennsylvania is going to convince them to build the road in Pennsylvania. So anyway, not happy probably that Braddock and Franklin meet and get along together, but of course they get along together because Franklin provides the general with what it is he wants. And he does it by making it worthwhile to the people providing the horses. It's really not that complicated, people. The general, by the way, Braddock, boasts to Franklin that the war is going to be very short. He told Franklin, "After taking Fort Duquesne, I am to proceed to Niagara, and having taken that, to Frontenac. If the season will allow time, and I suppose it will, for Duquesne can hardly delay me above 3 or 4 days." Now, Franklin had been reading about the early skirmishes. He'd been reading the writings of George Washington and reading about how the indigenous Americans, the Indians, fought. And he tells Braddock, you know, that it may take a little longer than you think, that these Indians are masters of ambush. And Braddock is going to scoff at this, and he's going to say, "These savages may indeed be a formidable enemy to your raw American militia, but upon the king's regular and disciplined troops, sir, it is impossible they should make any impression." Well, after Braddock and his men march off, Philadelphians wanted to have a celebration with fireworks, and Franklin said that's kind of jumping the gun. Somebody says to Franklin, "What the devil? You surely don't suppose that the fort will not be taken?" And Franklin said, "I don't know that it will not be taken, but I know that the events of war are subject to great uncertainty." Now, Franklin's doubts turn out to be valid. They lose the battle. Braddock is routed and killed during the battle. Probably, and I'm guessing this, but probably by his own men. You know, that quote to Franklin is very interesting. Well, of course these Indians can't fight a well-trained militia. Well-trained militia meaning he's going to keep telling them to stand up in front of these French and Indian forces. Come out, go out of the woods, go out of the trees, and stand there in lines, because in certain situations that becomes psychologically pretty terrifying to people. In this situation, it becomes laughably stupid, and the Indians and the French stay behind trees and they shoot these people down. Now, the Virginians, God bless them, aren't so willing to follow orders, so they don't stand out there. Well, eventually, somebody shoots Braddock. Now, I don't know who, but I do know that if I was one of these British soldiers, and for 30 minutes, I'm watching all of my men walk up in lines and get shot, and I'm next in line, I'm shooting the old coot. Now, George Washington's going to see all this, and I think I talked to you earlier about the fact that a big part of winning this war is demystifying the idea of British perfectibility and British power, and watching them foolishly lose this battle, and watching them foolishly stand up in lines to be shot down, will no doubt have an effect on General George Washington of the Revolution. At any event, the loss at Fort Duquesne proves shocking to Philadelphians. Now, what's going to happen next is the Assembly is going to send Governor Morris a bill with a property tax applicable to all real and personal property within the province and connect this to protection of the area. And this has been a long-standing fight. So it seems that they're trying to sneak this property tax in a new way, and Franklin is going to say, "How odious it must be to a sensible many people to find him who ought to be their father and protector taking advantage of public calamity and distress, and their tenderness for their bleeding country to force down their throats laws of imposition abhorrent to common justice and common reason. Why will the governor make himself the hateful instrument of reducing a free people to the abject stage of vassalage?" When the governor objected to the use of the word vassalage, Franklin became even more personal, showing that they were actually in a state worse than vassals. "Vassals must follow their lords to the wars in defense of their lands. Our lord proprietary, though a subject like ourselves, would send us out to fight for him, while he keeps himself 1,000 leagues remote from danger. Vassals fight at their lord's expense, but our lord would have us defend his estate at our defense." So that's Franklin. Now I tell you about all this in order to show you that all of our revolutionary tendencies don't start in Boston after the Stamp Act. There's hundreds of events going on. These are little fires that are starting in 100 different places. And if you want to ask what is it that connects them all, you might point to the Enlightenment. Now, as always, there's an economic issue at stake here. Americans did not come to this continent merely to survive. They came here to thrive. They came here because potential riches were limitless. And now they feel that the British are looking on them as competitors and holding them down. And this the Americans will not put up with. Now, I'm not going to take the time to go through all of the disputes that Benjamin Franklin has with the Penns. You know, William Penn comes out here, and he is, of course, a Quaker. It's illegal to be a Quaker in England. He's actually tried at one point for being a Quaker. Makes a great argument to the jury, such a good argument that, or so it's said, he's found not guilty, but the jury is thrown in jail. In any event, he's sent to America, and people are always asking, well, why would the king give him this land grant in America? Well, he's from a very prestigious family. His father was a great admiral, and the king owes money to the Penn family, and all of these things may have played a role. But at any point, William Penn is a very forward-looking, intelligent man. You know, if you ever come out and visit Philadelphia, as I've said before, contact us at bowtietours.com, and I will give you a tour of this place. And what you see as you walk along, you know, Philadelphia is very special. Because if you go on the Boston tour, which is something you should definitely do, and I did that. I took a tour with Boston by foot, and that's who I would suggest you take a tour with if you go out to Boston. It's a nonprofit, has guides who are interested in history, just as Bowtie Tours does. But in any event, Boston, it's all grown, everything's in the same place. You've got the Old North Church, right by skyscrapers, but Philadelphia separated the colonial part of the city from the main part of the city. The main part, Center City, is about 10 blocks away from the colonial part. So as we walk along, we see where George Washington's house was. We see where Benjamin Franklin's house was. We see where Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. And we see all these trees. We see all this grass. Well, that's how William Penn created it. Because, you know, again, it's the Enlightenment. William Penn sees that Paris and London are always burning down, and he says, well, how can we're going to create this new city. How can we make a city that won't burn down? Well, how about create a lot of space? How about grass, trees, brick buildings, wide streets? And as we take this tour, you will walk along and you will see all of this. You will see the very wide streets and the space and the grass, all that's done to protect the city from burning down. So I don't know if you all heard, I'm sorry about the phone going off there, but you'll be happy to know it's from my daughter. I haven't heard from her in weeks, but she says she's in Donousa, D-O-N-O-U-S-S-A. I don't even know where that is. Pictures forthcoming. So I am delighted. I am delighted to hear from my daughter, Michaela, who I haven't heard from in weeks. So always good to know what frigging island your child happens to be on. Anyway, where was I? William Penn is going to create a city based on many of these ideas. And you know what he says that's interesting? He calls this the seed of a new country. So unlike his children, maybe he would have been open to the revolution. His children and grandchildren are not, though. And Benjamin Franklin is going to have a lot of fights with the Penn family. And if I were to discuss all of those fights with you, that this would take several extra episodes. At one point, I might do a series on Benjamin Franklin, and then we can talk to them. But leave it to say that Benjamin Franklin is a fighter for the people of Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and is constantly asserting their rights against the control and dominion of England. You know, Franklin was controlled by his brother. He was his brother's, basically his indentured servant. And that's where he learns that he doesn't like being ordered about by somebody who has no, in his mind, right to order him about. And that's going to carry over to the relationship between England and Pennsylvania. Now, at one point, Benjamin Franklin is going to take on a central role in winning approval of a militia bill, and he personally takes charge of raising the troops and supervising them. Colonel Franklin is going to defend the people of Philadelphia with his militia. Now, Franklin has what's clearly a naive belief that this idea is going to satisfy everybody. After all, they had a common enemy, France. And he had taken it on himself to raise a militia without the need for British economic assistance. Well, who can complain about that? Well, as you can guess, the British can. Because they see what Franklin doesn't yet see, doesn't even think about. Which is, if Benjamin Franklin can create a militia to defend against France, Benjamin Franklin can create a militia to defend against England. Well, Franklin's not thinking about that. He's thinking that his city is in danger. But England is. Thomas Penn, who's the head of the Penn family that Benjamin Franklin has many dealings with, says, "I have scarcely seen such an instance of baseness as in this of Franklin's." In Penn's eyes, Franklin is full of Republican principles and never should have been made colonel of a militia. Now, Penn is going to convince Governor Morris to create an anti-Franklin military unit. And people start to worry that these two military units are, of course, going to fight each other. And then France, all they have to do is wait for the two Philadelphia militia units to kill each other off, and then France can just march right into Philadelphia. Now, Thomas Penn's complaint about Franklin and his militia would change from time to time, but his real concern was obvious, and he stated it to Governor Morris. "The militia is taken out of the hands of the crown, and the appointment of officers given to the people, which can never be allowed." Folks, this isn't going to work, is it, this America with England thing? I mean, all of the basic beliefs of the Americans are running counter with the basic assumptions of the British. Now, Franklin knows that he's no military leader. The Times called for a militia, and he agreed to do it. But when Governor Morris, at a time of great peril, offered Franklin a generalship if he would lead a campaign to capture Fort Duquesne, Franklin smells a rat, and he rejected the offer, saying, "I had not so good an opinion of my military abilities as he professed to have." See, Franklin sees wisely enough that the offer is a trap. He wants Franklin, when I say he, Governor Morris wants Franklin marching into Fort Duquesne, losing, and then he's not going to have to worry about this Colonel Benjamin Franklin anymore. Not saying that he thinks he's going to be killed, but that he'll lose any trust from the people that he's a military leader. Now, this whole episode does little to enhance Franklin's military reputation, and he resigned his position at the earliest possible opportunity, as soon as there was no more immediate danger. But it did bring him to the attention of local citizens as a man willing to defend their rights against British incursion. Now, in January of 1757, the Assembly appointed him their agent to the government in England. Thomas Penn was far less concerned about Franklin being in England than if he had stayed in Philadelphia, and he wrote that his Republican schemes will get nowhere. "Mr. Franklin's popularity is nothing here," he wrote. "He will be looked very coolly upon by great people. There are very few of any consequence that have heard of his electrical experiments, those matters being attended to by a particular set of people, many of whom of the greatest consequence I know well. But it is quite another sort of people who are to determine the dispute between us. I do not care how soon he comes, and am no ways uneasy at the determination." Now, he arrives in England, Franklin does, and he receives a summons from Lord Granville, the president of the Privy Council, which was the body of King George's closest advisers. Granville is also Thomas Penn's brother-in-law, by the way. Now, Granville is going to explain to Franklin that Franklin had the wrong ideas of the nature of your constitution. "You contend that the king's instructions to his governors are not laws, and think yourselves at liberty to regard or disregard them at your own discretion. Not so. They are, so far as relates to you, the law of the land, for the king is legislator of the colonies." Now Franklin responded that this was new doctrine to him, and that under their charters, the colonies made the laws for themselves and for their assemblies. When he meets with Thomas Penn to continue the same argument, Franklin is going to note that his father, William Penn, had written the charter for Pennsylvania that declared the Assembly of Pennsylvania to have the power and privilege of legislating. Benjamin Franklin would never forget Penn's answer. Penn told him that this was more than his father was empowered to grant under the Royal Charter creating Pennsylvania, and that it therefore had no validity. Franklin replied that if this were true, all the people who had been drawn to Pennsylvania under the belief that they would have such a privilege would have been deceived and cheated and betrayed by Franklin's father. Penn responded that they should have looked out for themselves, since the Royal Charter was no secret. "That," Franklin recalled, he said with a kind of triumphing, laughing insolence, such as a low jockey might do when a purchaser complained that he had cheated him in a horse. I was astonished to see him thus meanly give up his father's character, and conceived that moment a more cordial and thorough contempt for him than I ever before felt for any man living, a contempt that I cannot express in words, but I believe my countenance expressed it strongly." Penn, who was informed of this letter, heard what Franklin wrote, called it a most impudent paper, and a vile misrepresentation of what passed. And as to how Franklin looked at the time, noted that he could not tell, but that "my brother says like a malicious villain, as he always does." So, now you can see that there's no love lost between Franklin and the British. The surprising thing about all of this is that Benjamin Franklin appears to absolutely love living in London. In fact, he's going to end up living one-fifth of his life in London. He's going to dine with the Prime Minister, he's going to dine with members of Parliament and kings, as well as England's most esteemed intellectuals. He'll dine with David Hume, Joseph Priestley, Francis Dashwood, James Boswell. And during his years in England, people feel that to a great extent he loses his connection to America. A lot of these guys in this generation, their dream is to become British gentlemen. That's what George Washington wanted. Now, he didn't want to do it necessarily in England, but all of his beliefs of what it was he wanted to be came from this idea of being the British gentleman. And that's what Franklin wants. We look at his paintings at this time. We don't see anybody with a raccoon tail hanging off his hat. We see a man who looks like a British gentleman with a wig. Franklin had serious disputes with the Penns, but he didn't view them as disputes against England. He thought that at its core, England would do the right thing at the end. So when British puts forward the Stamp Act in 1765, Franklin said that to oppose this was like opposing the setting of the sun, and he goes out and he gets friends and family. Positions as tax collectors. And this is when even more people in America are going to decide that this Franklin's no good. He's a British spy. What Franklin wants to do is engineer a reunification between the parties. And he's going to make a big mistake. He is going to engineer the first WikiLeaks. He's going to see to it. And I won't go through all the mechanics of how this happens. He doesn't publish this letter himself, but the letter comes from him, a letter written by Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson. And in the letter, Hutchinson says that some of the rights of the Americans need to be bartered away, something like that. And what Franklin believes is if we can get this thing published, then we can blame all the problems that had been happening. You know, we've had the Boston Tea Party at this point, all of these different issues. Well, we can blame Hutchinson, and then we can work with the king. So what he's trying to do is bring the parties together. But that's not how things are going to work. He's going to end up being exposed. He's going to be brought into the British Parliament, and he is going to be insulted. Some people say this goes on for 3 hours. Some people say it goes on for 1 hour. But the Solicitor General, Alexander Wedderburn, is going to call him all sorts of names. He calls him the true incendiary and the first mover and prime conductor. He had forfeited all the respect of societies and of men. Now, this is dumb. Okay, this is real dumb. Benjamin Franklin is the most well-known, most respected of any of the people in the American colonies. He's beloved around the world. And here's the other thing. He's not a radical. He's trying to bring you guys together. Why he would declare war on Benjamin Franklin, I don't know, but they did. And that's when they're going to lose Franklin. That's when Franklin is going to become a true revolutionary. This is what Gordon Wood wrote. By publicly humiliating Franklin in this brutal manner, the British government may have vented some of its rising hostility toward its rebellious colonists, but at the same time it virtually destroyed the affections of the only colonist in England who might have brought about reconciliation. What Franklin whispered into Wedderburn's ear was this: I will make your master a little king for this. And that's it. John Adams writes about, I have crossed the Rubicon. Let the bridges be burned behind me. Come what may, come what may. Well, this is how Franklin feels at this point. When Franklin arrives at the Second Continental Congress, people still aren't sure they trust him. One person tells John Adams, well, he's always just sitting there, never talking. John Adams, who has a lot of issues with Benjamin Franklin, but he knows Franklin's a true supporter of liberty and independence. John Adams, in response to the man's words that he's never talking, says, did it ever occur to you that perhaps he's listening? Well, Franklin is going to become a great revolutionary. He's going to be the person Thomas Jefferson shows the Declaration of Independence to for the very first time, and we think he makes one pretty key change. Originally it says, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable, and we think that Franklin's the one who changes that to, we hold these truths to be self-evident. He's then going to go on to France to help bring about the relationship with France, and when he finally returns to America, it's going to be in order to take part in the new constitution that's being created. So I want to thank you very much for joining us. We're going to leave with our theme song. You know, people have been telling me, well, you got to get music at the end of the show, and I've been having technological difficulties, so I'm going to do something with the guitar here, right? Now, for those of you out here who say, oh, you can play guitar, I didn't say that. Oh, we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. So Benjamin Franklin came along, so I made this marathon. Chasing American history, my friends. What he did just might shock you. Said I won't do what you tell me to. Chasing American history, my friends. He released a personal letter. Maybe you should have thought about a better. Chasing American history, my friends. He told the king, go to hell. Going back to the Liberty Bell. Chasing American history, my friends. He did some lap diplomacy. Said the French will join us, you'll see. Chasing American history, my friends. Helped to make the nation start. Wrote about beer, wrote about farts. Chasing American history, my friends. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week as we talk about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. Chasing American history, my friends. We're chasing American history, chasing American history, chasing American history, my friends. See you next week.